911, what's your emergency?
Aha, this is Benoit Blanc.
Oh, are you calling to report a murder?
No, I'm stuck on a cliff.
You guys, you might think that today's opening stinger makes no sense, and you would be right, but believe us when we tell you that none of our other options made any more sense.
No, they didn't. And also, I came to the table with idea Benoit Blanc impression, and Jane said, "That's stupid and cringe." And then I asked, "What's your ideas?" And she said, "I don't have any." So we went with mine.
Right. Well, to be fair, we did workshop yours too. Okay, let's tell everybody the thought process here.
Okay.
You started out with, I want to do the Benoit Blanc impression because this episode reminded me of Knives Out, Glass Onion. And mm-hmm. I was like, I feel like the joke of just, basically you wanted to call and be like, I'm Benoit Blanc and there's been a murder. And we didn't really have a punchline. So then we workshopped it a little. And we decided to do a bait and switch where he's not reporting a murder. He's the guy from the beginning of the episode who's trapped on a cliff looking for buried treasure. But then we both agreed that it was funnier if he doesn't even say he's looking for buried treasure. He's just stuck on a cliff.
I don't even want to get into the Glass Onion discussion because I know everyone's going to side with you and I'll be alone again. But
well,
I like Glass Onion. I like Glass Onion. That's all I'll say.
Okay. I didn't like hate it. I didn't think it was, it's kind of an annoying movie. But welcome back to the First Risk podcast, everybody.
Welcome back, everybody. today we are discussing season 4, episode 12, Treasure Hunt.
Treasure Hunt, directed by David Grossman, written by Bob Goodman. Ooh, it's another Grossman and Goodman episode.
Oh my God, like the modern day Gilbert and Sullivan, if you will.
Literally.
Like truly comic geniuses.
They're like Siskel and Ebert.
Really tapping into the zeitgeist with this one. I think this episode, and this is going to be a very large statement, this episode might be my favorite one we've ever watched.
Wow. I think.
It's so fun.
I do really like this one, and I feel like I like it because there's really just not any other 911 episode like this, I feel. You know, even ones like Ocean's 911 or whatever, a kind of heist episode, feel more replicable than this somehow.
I think it's because what they really nailed with this episode was the tone, you know, they really leaned heavily into like the absurdity and like sort of the audacity of this entire situation and like really got all of the characters fully invested and they didn't hold anything back. And that's what I appreciated about it. It was just sort of a no holds barred romp. And it's like with things like Ocean's 911, they still try to like pepper in moments of like genuinely harrowing stuff with like, oh, what if Hen's dying? And it's like very like somewhat serious and dramatic juxtaposed with the fact that she's locked in a bank vault.
This one really doesn't take itself seriously for a moment. Yeah.
No, it doesn't. Like the most serious like it gets is like lingering on like Buck's blue balls, and even then,
no, literally,
like, it's impossible to take that seriously because, oh, his poor little blue balls. Oh, by the way, bit of housekeeping before we get into the episode. We were just talking about movies. How was Five Nights at Freddy's 2?
Well, I did take Buzz Balls into it, and I can't say they really helped. I honestly just found it boring. Like, I kept checking my watch. I was like, this is like a hour and 30 minute movie. How does it feel so long?
That's what I heard. I heard that like it wasn't even like campy bad. It was just like in the way that like a lot of the first one was. And even
I was
then,
in a I wasn't a packed like house though. Much. I wasn't a packed house. There were all these kids around me, including like, we saw a mom with two really little kids come in at first, and I was like, okay, this is still like a horror movie. Like, why? This doesn't feel appropriate. And then, but there were a few like Five Nights at Freddy's like lore enjoyers in the crowd, I think, because there was this guy behind us who every once in a while I would hear him like lean over to his girlfriend or whatever and be like, point out a lore Easter egg to her. Like at one point they play some recording in the movie and he leans over to the girl he's with and he's like, "That's the FNAF beatboxer."
Like she's Paris Hilton at the basketball game, right?
Right. So that I was enjoying.
So were there more cameos? Like, did Matt Pat come up again? Did they finally get Markiplier out of his
one
cave?
One interesting thing. I mean, I don't know that I would even recognize like a FNAF celebrity if they showed up in this movie. But one interesting thing is this one has Skeet Ulrich in it. Not for a long time. He's like credited like way sooner than you would think for the amount of time he has in the movie. But so this movie is a reunion between Skeet Ulrich and Matthew Lillard since Scream. That's kind of fun. They don't have any scenes together, but they're both in it.
I'm sure they, you know, found each other on set one day and had crazy nasty sex in the trailers. And good for them, you know. Love those
boys.
Yeah,
for legal reasons, that was a joke.
Hey, if they want to deny it, they can come on the First Risk podcast. If they want to deny it, they can say it to our faces.
That's true. That's true. Skeet, we'll do a Matthew, video call. Come on. Do you think, is his name really Skeet? Do you think his friends call him Skeet? That's crazy.
Gotta be a stage name, right? I'm actually gonna Google this right now because it has to be a stage name. Skeet Ulrich.
Ooh. Skeet Ulrich, I recently received a very juicy DM from someone telling me that allegedly someone is working on a viewable version of the cursed Wes Craven's director's cut, the original version of the movie Cursed before it got fucked with by the studio.
Huge for you. Oh,
yes.
Wow.
Which, of course, the original version featured Skeet Ulrich in one of the main roles, which was not true of the final released version. So I don't know if that's like classified information. I got a DM from someone who had screenshots of like a private account.
I mean, there's
I'm
no
not
way
naming any names.
That's not like a breach. That's not like an NDA. If anything, is a like breach. That's like a scoop. We're scoopers on this
right.
pod.
I got a scoop. I got a scoop, you guys. Allegedly, it is coming.
The only person who cares about cursed Wes Craven.
Yeah, right. Does it count as, does it even matter if you like breach classified information if it's a thing nobody gives a shit about except for like five people?
I just Googled
that'll be exciting.
It. Mm. I just Googled it. And his name is even funnier than Skeet Ulrich. His name, his birth name is apparently Brian Ray Trout, as in the fish.
As in the fish, yeah.
And when he grows his beard out, he becomes a fur-bearing trout. We love to see
it. I wonder where Skeet came from. I feel like Skeet, you know, it should be short for like Skitchard or something.
Skenry. I went to Skeeter. You went to Skitchard. Like it's a knockoff like shoe from Indonesia or something like that.
My Skitchard slip-ons. Today's episode is Treasure Hunt. We're both a big fan, and Ryan only has 2 hours before he has to go to work, so we better get on this.
Mm-hmm.
So this episode begins.
So there's this father and daughter.
With a father and daughter duo. The daughter is a cool nerd science girl. She's like, "Look, Dad, it's this scientific name of a tree." This chauvinistic pig dad is like, "I liked it better when you memorized the names of dolls." And the daughter's like, "I never played with dolls." And they're like, "Oh, ho, ho." And then they walk off.
I was identifying with this girl so hard on her little botanical hike because this was so me when I was like a little kid and I was obsessed with Pokemon. And so we'd watch like the Pokemon movies and I would be this little girl. But instead of like sagebrush and like birch trees, I'd be like pointing out that one's a Wormadam. That one's a Cherim. That one's a Vespiquen. Like, and like my parents would be like, "Ryan, we don't give a fuck."
Right. Your special interest was not something you could like go to college for. unfortunately. Yeah,
unfortunately. Although it is something that's probably more profitable if I decided to become a Poketuber, because I think they make good money.
True. In this economy, that is probably the more lucrative job. But I did think this was true to life of how dads are with their daughters, especially, where they'll just say something and you're like, oh, that's not actually true of me at all. And also, like, do you even know me or know anything about my interests? And then you just have to kind of move on. But yeah, the show is not depicting this as a negative relationship. They're just like, they're, you know, laughing to each other. They're on this beautiful hike. And the girl stops by a creek and she finds a message in a bottle. She's like, look at this. Can you believe this? They open it up and they're like, is that blood on the note inside the bottle? And they call 911. Okay.
And who should answer?
You gotta.
Who should answer but Jennifer Love Hewitt, getting her one brief scene of the episode.
Literally, poor Maddie. I've never really noticed how kind of sidelined. She has a baby in this season, and then they're like, okay, bye, Maddie.
Yeah, that's honestly, that's going to be a point against season four for me. Just the absolute dearth of Maddie content. And I'm going to be so honest. This might be, you know, like chauvinist of me to say. I liked Maddie's storylines better before she had the baby. Now, granted, we get some good storylines after she has the baby. We get one really good drawn out one. But then I think they completely put the skids on Maddie's storylines altogether.
Wow, Ryan Kearns. You heard it here first. Ryan Kearns says women who have babies are worth less.
And did.
You're always saying that.
And
you're
I believe that. I'm saying that off the air and now on the air, you know? So this is just a nice peek behind the curtain.
Right, right. But the dad and daughter, they call 911 and they're like, yeah, we think someone's trapped on a cliff. It's Benoit Blanc. And Maddie's like, what do you mean, like, you think? They're like, oh, he might be over here. Like, we can't actually see him. And she's like, what do you mean? Like, how do you know he's up there? And they're like, we found a message in a bottle. And the message says, help, I'm trapped on a cliff. Call 911. After which we get our title card.
He didn't even write, like, 911, like, the numbers. He wrote 9-1-1, like the title of the show, for continuity's
sake.
Like
the title of the show. Yeah, yeah. Well, you couldn't have people misinterpreting it as call 911.
But that would require, like, a slash. I respect the specificity in this moment of peril. He said, I want to be very clear about
the
this.
Brand consistency.
You know, this is a man dedicated to the network.
but later, everybody's on the scene. There's a rescue helicopter, which once again, let's thank God that we didn't get a Tommy Gennard cameo. Because there's a rescue helicopter in this scene.
We're
going to
keep saying, thank God there's no Tommy. And then one day, out of the blue,
Tommy's going to show up. Don't make me think about it. Don't make me think about it. We've still got a few seasons until then. But the 118
is on
the scene.
At this point. It'll probably be this time next year we'll get reintroduced to Tommy Gennard.
Well, that'll be interesting. Yes, the 118 arrives. Everybody's on the scene. There's like a whole rescue team. There's a cute little beagle. There's a cute little doggy sniffing around. They're like, how do we know this message in a bottle was even recent? And they say it was written on the back of a receipt. They track the receipt. It's only from 5 days ago. So it's reasonable that this guy could still be alive.
They end up 8,000 acres of land to search for this one guy. Like, I would see that assignment and I would just be like, so Bobby, I feel like I'm coming down with something. It's just
Bobby,
it's really not
hear me
COVID
out.
Safe
what
to,
if
for me
we
to be
just
here.
Left.
Yeah, what if we like gave this to like the B squad, like that new guy Ravi, he you know, he's a little wet behind the ears. Maybe he could stand to get a little action going. Do
well,
the grunt work.
Well, they're like, let's put a couple guys up in the helicopter. Chimney, Eddie, get in the helicopter, which first of all, Eddie has something to do. That's fun. And Buck is looking all disappointed. I think he's supposed to be disappointed that he didn't get to do the exciting rescue. But imagine, maybe he's actually disappointed that he didn't get to partner up with Eddie in this scene. It could be either one.
It could be either one. I will say I am leaning more towards the canon version of events because we just watched for our Patreon the Lone Star crossover episode. And in that episode, Buck didn't get to go up in the chopper either. And it was also a point of contention. So
good plug, Ryan. Always be plugging.
Always be plugging. And I assume Justin is doing the same thing at his work. thank you for that, Justin. We love you. And the chopper is in the air. The chopper is in the air, flying over sunny, whatever part of California this is. Now, these
beautiful
mountains,
mountain range.
I wouldn't say beautiful. I think they're kind of ugly. They are very arid.
You're in the California mountains.
I just don't like them. They're not real mountains to me. But they are very rocky, and they find Benoit Blanc chilling with his little cliff cella setup over here, all dehydrated and shit. Like, hey, you got my bottle. Hey, you got my bottle. And so Eddie comes down with the electrolyte drink, and he is excited because he gets to touch a man, because he we find out the guy ran out of food and water like 5 days ago. His name's Clyde.
Right.
He was searching for willow trees. He fell and he broke his foot, and it's like so swollen.
Yeah, it's pretty nasty.
He didn't even think to like take the knife and just put a little stint in there to drain the fluids.
Nor did he think to take a knife and just cut his foot off to save us all this trouble. But yeah, Eddie puts it in a little splint. He's like, we'll get you to a hospital. And the guy's like, no, I'm fine. Just like do whatever you need to do. And I got a couple spots I still got to check out. And he's like, what? He kind of assumes the guy's delirious. He gets him in the harness and starts pulling him up to the helicopter. This wide shot of like Eddie and the guy clinging to each other in the air.
It's romantic. So it's lush.
It's so romantic.
Eddie has his legs wrapped around the man. It is incredible.
Oh my God. I know of a Bollywood movie so relevant for this situation.
Let's hear it.
Everybody watch Veer Zara for Veer Zara. It's two names. The guy's named Veer and the girl's named Zara. And it's like an Indo-Pakistani love story. Mm-hmm. And it's set in the 80s. And there's a part where Shah Rukh Khan has to helicopter Preeti Zinta up into the air on the rope. And it's just like this. But anyway, you can tell in this shot that it's a stunt double, right? Because it's a stunt. But I like to imagine that Ryan Guzman requested a stunt double, not because of the danger of the stunt, but because he didn't want to look too gay.
Didn't want to look too gay. You know, I was noticing the ass looked noticeably flatter. So I'm glad that you pointed that out. I will say, and not to continue my longstanding tradition of ragging on Southern California geography in this show, but I was not buying the peril of this situation because these mountains are not nearly imposing enough. I'm sorry.
Well, here's a counterpoint. He makes it clear that, first of all, he has a broken ankle. So kind of regardless of how treacherous the terrain is, he can't move. But also, he makes it clear that he didn't actually intend to get rescued and leave. He just wanted to get enough help that he could keep going on his way. So I don't think we even necessarily have to assume that like he couldn't get down were he in better shape. I think that's understandably part of it.
And I'm saying to production, I don't give a fuck. Up the ante. Get him high in the air.
You think he should have been in like a volcano full of sharks and stuff?
Yes, absolutely.
That would have been awesome.
I would have bought it. Oh my God. I would have bought in so hard. but instead we get him basically just like, oh, he tripped while he was running up that hill. It doesn't hurt me. I want to see the willow trees.
Well, I, to the credit of production, I thought this whole sequence looked very expensive. I thought it was kind of impressive. You know, I feel like when I watch like a Grey's Anatomy episode where they're on some unique terrain, it's usually pretty obviously CGI and green screens. So I was impressed that they like put a real guy dangling out of a helicopter above these cliffs. You know, it's kind of cool.
That's true. You said that, and I immediately went back to redacted character's death scene, on the getting creamed on the freeway or whatever happened to him.
Right.
That's what that was giving. Green screen core. And listen, the terrain in that scene was pretty true to life, because that's what, you know, when you go east of the mountains, that's basically all that Washington looks like. But
well, they're,
you know,
rescuing the guy.
They're rescuing the guy.
They let everybody know he's kind of delirious, just so you know. And because the guy is still going like, I'm fine. I just get me back out there. We find that he has a cell phone, but he's like, oh, it died, so I couldn't call for help. It died 3 days ago. And they're like, that's after you got injured. Why didn't you call for help? And he says, because I had to keep looking for the treasure. And they're all just kind of like, what? Bobby, specifically, Bobby's bemused expression in is so funny. He's like, the guy's like, I didn't want anyone else to find the treasure. It's mine. The treasure's mine. like the camp in this episode, it's such a like pulp novel scenario that to watch all these modern characters react to it, I think is very funny.
Bobby's bemused. Buck, in his little aviator shades, his Ray-Bans or whatever, is so immediately taken
by this.
He's like, did you just say
treasure? You say
treasure?
Buck is the kind of guy, you know, Buck has had to replace his computer like every 6 months because he probably falls for every phishing email. That's probably why his credit's so bad. He's probably fallen for a million scams. He's probably on all the sports betting apps.
That was his bisexual awakening. His bisexual awakening was the Nigerian prince who needs his credit card information. That, like, he's like, oh my God, I'm getting married.
He's like blushing. He's like, me?
Oh. I have to say, before we wheel this guy off and get into the story, he is so sunburned. He is so sunburned. The skin damage is going to be insane. The melanomas that will form because of this little stunt of his. Like, he will never forget.
He did not bring
his
La Roche-Posay sunscreen with him on his little excursion.
He needs to be wearing his SPF like 700 because he's been out here for like, you know, eons at this point. And Bobby and Buck are just standing there like, so what was that about the treasure? And then who do we go to?
Taylor Kelly is on the scene, not on the scene, but she's reporting about the death of a pulp mystery writer. His name is what? Hollis Harcourt?
It is Hollis Harcourt. I wrote down in my notes Harlan Thrombey because we're continuing the Knives Out theme. I assume this episode is very formative for Rian Johnson, even though it came out after the first one.
Maybe if anything it was inspired by Knives Out.
I think it came out after the second one, didn't it?
Interesting. Probably. Yeah.
Concerning.
That was, what, like 2020, 2021. But
looking into
it. Yeah. This mystery writer played by that famous character actor. I forget his name, but the guy from Mulholland Drive. We all know the one. He has died at the age of 57. He passed away in his sleep. Taylor Kelly is in front of the like wrought iron gate in front of his, you know, Victorian looking mansion. And apparently before he died, this guy recorded a message to all his fans saying, my final gift to the citizens of Los Angeles is this buried treasure that I've hidden in this treasure chest. It's worth $5 million and I've hidden it somewhere. And I've written a poem kind of a riddle to guide you to the treasure.
He doesn't say it's worth $5 million. He says it's priceless, but for tax purposes, we can say it's about $5 million.
So I guess you could say it's not priceless, Hollis.
Yeah, there's a price tag on it, sir, for government purposes. But you know what? It's the experience that is truly priceless. And he he does some ego stroking. He's like, if you're as clever as, you know, you think you are, you'll find this chest. And everyone takes that very personally. And then we get a short interview with his little, you know, chambermaid Jeremiah over here.
It's not even Smithers.
It's his Smithers. He's Mr. Burns.
It's his little gay pathetic assistant. It's his Smithers. Yeah.
It's incredible. It's incredible. And so then they start they start doing what Jane did when Ryan Guzman posted cringe. They start reading the poem and ripping it to shreds.
Yeah, no, I loved this. They're reading the poem and they're like, wow, this is just a badly written piece of prose.
Chimney in particular is not having it with this one.
Right. This was great because I was like, Chimney, what is your like poetry critic backstory? Did you minor in college? Well, I don't think he canonically even went to college, but like, did he in one of his, you know, little short career stints, was he like a slam poetry reporter or something? I don't know. I need to know.
I don't see that for him. What I do see for him is like a man who, like, he's not like that well read in poetry, but he has like one or two poems that are like really important to him. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
Like, he, like,
that's kind of my relationship to poetry.
And at a very formative time in his life, he like read like a Robert Frost or like a T.S. Eliot that like really spoke mm-hmm. to him. And he was never the same. And it's like, you just know if he committed to it and like really like dug deep into like, I don't know, Eva MD or like, you know, I'm trying to name poets. I don't know a lot of poets. I'm not a poetry
Ada
guy.
Adelie Moan or Gwendolyn Brooks.
Rupi Kaur, Gabby Hanna. He would just get his life. And so they're all tearing the poem to shreds, but it's not a poem. It's more of a riddle, and it's a terrible
riddle.
That's
what Bobby says anyway.
And they're all like sort of like, you know, laughing it off like, oh, this is funny. This is so trite and cute.
Right.
And they don't know what kind of trouble they're getting into, because you can already start to see the spark of inspiration in the eyes of Buddy, in the eyes of, there's a little bit of a gleam in like in Hen's eye a little bit when she's going through, even though she's playing it off. And they're commenting on the fact that this is getting a lot of traffic,
mm-hmm.
and it's probably not going to bode well, because as these things go, when you start sort of a mass I don't want to say mass hysteria, a surge of mass excitement like this around like mm-hmm. a singular cause or like tangible thing, that can lead to interesting results. And so for a real world example, we all remember where we were July of 2016, do we not? We were playing Pokemon Go. And
oh, right. I was like, I actually don't.
And I don't know if you guys saw that viral clip that went around that was covered on the news. It was when, I think it was, where was it? It was in California where a Snorlax spawned, and you saw this massive, massive horde of people just like migrating to it like a wave. Pokemon Go Summer was the absolute best. Like, the only time I felt anything close to that level of unity was Brat Summer, and that was different.
That was different.
So anyways.
Buck gets a call from none other than Taylor Kelly, who's like, you heard about this treasure, boy? And he says, I have, but, you know, it's probably all fake. And Taylor's like, I'm not so sure. You know, I interviewed the assistant Smithers, and off the record, he said that he himself saw the treasure. And, you know, he kept it off the record because he didn't want people to come find him if this treasure thing really takes off. So Buck's like, oh, this is, you mean this is real? Two dumb bitches telling each other exactly.
No, he's seriously. Like, they match like, each other's stupid real? So hard.
No, but in a great way. They're like, in a great way. I bet if we teamed up, we could find this thing. And they're sort of like, put, you know, doing a little facetious, like, well, we'd really be doing a public service, you know, if we find it, then everybody'll stop looking for it and nobody else will get hurt. But then, you know, he's like, everybody wins. Well, maybe not everybody. He looks over at the rest of the 118. So it's like, oh, Buck's going to go find it on its own and then leave it all.
Well, not on his own. Well, not on his own, you know, because
well,
the dynamic
apart from
duo
the rest
is
of the
born
for right now. Yes.
Now,
yes,
I saw some
time.
Revisionist history on 911 Twitter the other day, where it was mm-hmm. like something along the lines of two characters that were greatest friends, but then were forced into a romance. And then it was like a picture
I
of
saw
Buck
that
Taylor.
Too.
And like, and it was like, I totally get what you guys are going for here, but let's be honest.
Let's not lie to ourselves.
A lot of y'all hated Taylor from the jump.
Because
she wasn't Eddie. So while I see the vision, you also can't delude yourself into thinking that this isn't the hottest thing in the world.
No, like watching it without like a fandom brain, I think that this is undeniably like a good pairing with chemistry. It's not like the most fascinating thing in the world. It's not like an organic gay ship level of like yearning and forbidden love, but yeah, it's like, it's just a good, you know, it doesn't feel forced to have them in a relationship, actually, I don't think.
No, I agree. I mean, like, they're literally, like, the way that they speak to each other when they're planning out this little scheme of theirs, like, they're, like, it's like, I don't have any other way to describe it other than, like, insane and incredible courtship ritual. It's like,
yeah, the only thing I would say is the peacock,
but then she's also the peacock, and they're both showing off for each other.
I think maybe instead of characters who were destined to be friends but were forced to be in a relationship, I feel like it's more like characters who were destined to be fuck buddies but were forced into a romantic relationship. I think
that's
kind of the difference, is they do have insane animal sexual chemistry, yeah. But I could agree that, like, emotionally, I don't know that there's that much there.
No, I would agree with that. But, like, I need Buck to have sex, okay? He's too much of a loser if he's not. I need him to retain that sort of raw, animalistic sort of sexual appeal. Otherwise, like, I just want to kick him around.
like a soccer ball.
Yeah,
well,
literally.
Well, I think he would agree with you in this episode because you, once again, you mentioned the subplot about Buck's blue balls. But elsewhere in the LAPD station.
This out-of-pocket line that immediately throws us into.
Athena sees all of her coworkers like standing around a computer watching something in amazement, and she walks over and goes, "Please tell me that's not porn or sports." As if her coworkers would be watching porn at work, all gathered around a computer together. Love that, and love the implication that perhaps she's seen that happen before.
I also love the implication. Crazy things go on
at the LAPD, I guess.
I love the implication that porn and sports are also two equivalent evils in the
equally
workplace
morally
for
bankrupt
Athena.
Things. Yeah, love that.
It's telling me a lot about her. I feel like Athena would kind of be into sports, but in like a particular kind of way. Like, I feel like she wouldn't really be into like football, but I feel like she, like, I don't know. Maybe she'd be like really into like the game of squash or just something niche. You know what I mean? Like,
she's watching cricket on the daily.
Exactly. Some sort of niche sport that she can't really share with people because nobody else gives a fuck. Maybe Athena's really into chess. I don't know. That feels like more of a Bobby thing, though. Bobby seems like a chess guy, kind of. Like a guy who plays chess, doesn't watch chess, but he's really serious about the game of chess. Anyways, Fabrizio's there.
They're all explaining to Athena about the treasure thing, and she's like, "Man, I miss when rich people would just, you know, name museums after themselves when they die." But she brings up a very good point once she learns about the treasure. She's like, "I wonder if we should get some squad cars out by his gravesite, because, you know, mm-hmm. that's one of the first places people are going to start digging." And everybody's like, "We didn't think of that. Send some units."
and then it's like, so how bad do we think this is going to get? And so we get, a Blondie one way or another needle drop
mm-hmm.
montage, treasure tracking, you know, like fucking disaster situation.
Yes.
Because this woman, we get like multiple like ridiculous scenarios. A woman that we start off with a woman being impaled by a tree. How?
Either a small tree or a tree branch. Yes. And it's so funny. They're filming her on the news and she's like trying to cover her face.
How did this happen? I have to know. How? Did she like lay down and let it grow into her like that old like torture method with bamboo? Like, did it fall?
Right, it was a very long process.
And then you get these two old men dueling with metal detectors. Oh, this was so funny.
Yes, they are trying to beat each other up with their metal detectors. So Athena has to come deal with that.
How good are these, like, what's the purpose of these, like, dousing machines? Like, when you have, like, a metal detector at the beach, what are you likely to find other than, like, scraps and shrapnel?
Well, I think they might be looking for, like, valuable scrap metal, like, I don't know, copper or some shit. I don't really know. Maybe just random
To recycle
treasures. I think you can sell that kind of thing. It's why people steal, like, copper wiring from, like, streetlights and stuff. Or at least they do that in my city.
No, that's a thing that happens. I'm not in that life. I'm sorry. I'm sure there are other things.
You know, maybe they're just trying their luck, like on a beach, you know, maybe they're just trying their luck for, like, if somebody lost a watch or something potentially valuable.
Oh, but then May Grant takes a call because a man has desecrated a bear statue. And as we all know, when you mess with the bear, you get the body. He has been body slammed by this bear statue.
Yeah, like a giant heavy metal bear statue has fallen down on this person. It's like cradling him on the ground.
It looks very
intimate, to be honest.
It does. It's kind of hot. And I too love being, you know, smothered and crushed by bears. Then we sort of cut back and forth. We see the old man hit the other old man with the metal detector. So of course they got to take him out and put him down like Old Yeller. And then
they're
getting the bear statue off of the guy, Eddie's like, well, I guess we can cross the Griffith Park bear statue off the list. And then we see Linda literally doing that because she has a bet with Jamal.
at the dispatch, everybody's got like a betting pool on various locations where the treasure might be.
It's so fun. And then it turns out that this is actually causing havoc and mayhem in the streets of LA because so far there have been six hospitalizations. Six hospitalizations and 17 arrests since this was announced. Now, Taylor Kelly is, of course, you know, reporting on all this. And as she is, this woman, this in a bout of female hysteria, runs out of the hospital and says, "It's a hoax. It's all a lie. Don't fall for these tricks." Taylor's like, thank you for your candor. And she's like, people are dying. My husband almost died.
Says, my husband almost died. More people are going to die.
Very prescient of her to say, might I add, because right away, we see a gentleman who has commandeered through some means our old friend, the excavator.
And the 118 are rushing up to him trying to say, don't dig here. You can't dig here. And then he starts digging there. They all run back to their truck. They're like, everybody take cover because this guy is seemingly about to hit a gas main. And he does. And it blows up spectacularly right onto a poor little innocent gazebo. What did the gazebo
the poor
ever
gazebo.
Do?
And of course, Hen, our forklift certified diva, walks over, shaking her head like, I could have told you that was going to happen. I've got experience.
Well, she says they never call before they dig.
And that is a callback. That is a callback to seize the day? Is that
Probably.
Seize the day? Probably.
You tell me.
She can't. So then after that we go to Buck's not the only one getting blueballed because Buddy at the ladder truck are polishing that shit as they do
and
Eddie's like
is pining over here. Eddie is down bad and he's like, hey, I guess everybody is working alone trying to find this treasure. it might be more helpful if two people teamed up. Like, maybe you and I should become a couple and explore each other's bodies and find the treasure along the way, maybe also.
Fingers touching. Please, woo, please.
And Buck is like, ooh, sorry, boyfriend. I already made a deal with my girlfriend, who's not my girlfriend yet. And but then Eddie like gives him the puppy dog eyes and Buck immediately folds. He's like, maybe I could let you in on our deal too.
Here's the thing. It's not a love triangle. It's a throuple. Guys, it's a throuple. And then it gets better.
I just can't see Taylor and Eddie working out is the only thing. It would have to be like a one-sided throuple. It'd have to just be like, this is Buck. This is Buck's girlfriend and this is Buck's boyfriend.
I don't know. I feel like I see it working out like because I see it being very rocky in the beginning, them not seeing eye to eye. And what makes it click is when Taylor pulls out the strap and shows him the time of his life. I think that's what sells it. But we don't get to linger on it because Taylor says, we're not splitting it 33%. You have to give him half of your share. And he's like, why? And she says, because I already promised half of my share to my cameraman. So we split it four ways. That's still more than a million each, etc. Guys, it's not even a thruple. It's a polycule.
That's true.
It's a polycule, guys.
Oh my god.
I am obsessed with this. This is canon. Do you think the cameraman holds the camera, or do you think he gets in on the action and puts the camera on the table? That's the question. But we
don't
have to
linger
on that.
I don't want to go too deep into this whole thing. Yeah. But Taylor and Buck start brainstorming, and Eddie's like trying to offer suggestions, and they're like, no, shut up, Eddie. That's not correct. And Eddie feels sad. He feels sidelined from the thruple. Mm-hmm. This is a real problem. This is like why I would be afraid of a thruple is like, how do you make everyone feel included?
Taylor is doing some arboreal work because she's identifying the arroyo cedar or whatever it is. Eddie's like, is that
Willow.
A tree? And she's like, it's more like a shrub. And I thought about that line from Glee. What's the difference between a bush and a shrub? It's a whole thing. It's hard to stop beneath a shrub. So it's like, what does this poem mean? I don't know. Whoever wrote it must have been a genius. Well, you know, I think, you know, we know a guy, whatever.
Back at the 118, Buck and Eddie are hazing Ravi by tricking him into
everyone
telling
say
them
hi,
about
Ravi.
All the... Hi, Ravi.
Hi,
they're
Ravi.
Tricking him. They're under the guise of being friendly with him. They're tricking him into telling them about all the calls he's witnessed involving people looking for the treasure so that they can narrow down the locations. And right. As they're doing this in the glass changing room, Hen and Chimney are watching from afar and they're like, do you see that? I think they've iced us out of their little treasure hunting deal, and I think it's time for us to make our own little treasure hunting deal.
So I love the rivalry that's getting set up here. Also, this is so what Ravi was talking about when he confronted Buck on like the whole like the using him as a replacement for Eddie thing, and it's like it took you 4 years to invite me out for drinks. How long did it take you with Eddie? And he's like, a day. Do you think Buck genuinely in his heart of heart likes Ravi?
I think he like at least thinks he does. I don't know that at this point he had spent enough time with him too, but I feel like in the present he probably does.
I mean, they got off on so the wrong foot, you know what I mean, with the whole Jinx thing. That I feel like that soured their relationship forever.
They did. And also I do feel like I don't think he dislikes Ravi. Like, I think he probably likes him well enough. But, you know, have you ever had those friends? It's sad, but have you ever had those friends that it's like you kind of hang out with them when like your better friends aren't around?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a real thing.
And it doesn't mean that they're bad or that you don't like them. It's just like you know, you get along with them, but not in as strong a way as you do with like your best friends. And so like, mm-hmm. you know, maybe you have coworkers like that, like if they're around, like you'll hang out, but they're not like coming to your wedding, you know?
Yeah, you would never choose to hang out with them. Maybe it's that Ravi.
Maybe Ravi's like that. And that's why he becomes a replacement for Eddie, is he's just like the next best thing when Eddie's gone. But
maybe
it's not the
maybe
same.
It's just because Buck doesn't respect Ravi. Maybe, and I think I know right. why. I think it's because Ravi
he's racist.
In season one. In season one, well, yes, his first season, in season four, Ravi is so little. He's so small. He's so little. He is. He's like mega twink material. And mm-hmm. as we know, Buck is into beefy boys with fat asses. So I feel like he just saw Ravi and is like, oh, let's steamroll this kid. You know, let's just absolutely like run him through the ringer. Because he could never make it as a Navy SEAL, etc. And don't mind that I didn't either.
He
just thinks that Robbie's pathetic because he doesn't lift that hard. And so he only invited him out for drinks after he got swole. Now, at the dispatch, they're mm-hmm. crossing off the observatory. It's not the observatory yes. because there was a call there. And apparently it was based on like Hollis's fifth book, Stabbed Beneath the Stars. Thank you, Linda. I knew you read these kind of books. I knew that about you.
Of course.
And
Maddie
then
takes another call.
They get a call.
And
yes.
it's a guy saying, there's ants everywhere. To which Maddie says, I'm sorry, did you say ants? And it's like, girl, you've got to stop responding to 911 calls like that. It doesn't matter if you misheard. You can't be all like TV incredulous over this. You have to get his location.
Don't bully her. She has two lines this episode. Don't
You're
bully
right.
her.
You're
She's
right.
getting her check. She had to draw
okay.
her screen time a little bit.
But the 118 shows up and this
oh
guy's fucking covered in ants.
Oh my
so
God.
So they're like, let's
Nightmare
just spray
scenario.
Him with the hose.
They're not yeah. just ants. They're fire ants.
They're fire ants.
And you just know they're everywhere. He's wearing shorts, so you know they're inside of his
shorts. They're probably
too.
In his butt crack, yeah.
Ew. Ugh. I can't. This is so disgusting. I hate ants. I hate ants. One of my biggest fears is being like covered in ants.
So Buck and Eddie homoerotically Freudianly turn on their big fire hose and they spray the guy all over his body. This is kind of a symbolically very homoerotic episode, what with Eddie clinging to that guy in the air and them, you know, spraying this guy down with the hose.
What is this symbolizing, like, homoerotically? Is this like a golden shower kink thing or like
we
what's...
could interpret it as Eddie's gay awakening. Or Eddie's latent desire to, I'll leave it up to the imagination.
Okay. Well, the important thing is this guy is covered in, like, hives because he's been
did you guys
bitten
ever
by
see,
thousands of fire ants.
Ryan, did you ever see the original producer's movie, the one with Gene Wilder?
That's, like, one of my favorite movies of all time.
Yeah, I love that movie. What I was thinking about in this scene when they started spraying him down is like, I'm covered in ants and I'm wet and I'm still hysterical. I'm in pain. I'm in pain and I'm wet and I'm hysterical.
So the ants got him fucked up. And Hen Chim, it's not a ship that's ever been thought about. So they didn't.
Him.
They don't have a name. Him.
They're him.
Him is in the ambulance and they immediately start interrogating the guy on why he would think to come out here, and he according to the subtitles he groans weakly. Now Athena is at the police station, and who should have jumped on this opportunity, who should have shown up like crawling out of the gutters but the goddamn porch pirate.
Oh, that's the porch pirate?
Yeah, it's the porch pirate.
Are you sure it's her?
I'm pretty sure it's the porch pirate.
I did not clock that at all. Are you sure it's not just another woman with a blonde bob who steals things?
I'm pretty sure it's the porch pirate.
I just need to check the credits real quick.
Oh, hold on. It's fully not the porch pirate.
Girl. You made me feel like I was losing my mind.
That's so unfortunate because there was immediately like a sense of like familiarity, like, oh shit, here we go again.
Yeah, she was
Athena.
In one episode of 911 and it was this one.
No.
I do kind of understand how you got there though, because yeah, she is a woman with a blonde bob stealing stuff.
And how charming would that be to across
that
multiple seasons
to
just have her be like the swiper no swiping of the show.
But knowing 911, I think they would give Athena like a really unsubtle line of like, it's the damn porch pirate, which I think is what she said the last time.
That's exactly what she said the last time. Did you say unsubtle? Because I meant I saw that and went to iconic. Wait, and then they bring in another guy who was like poking around the Manson tunnel. Now, did they mean like a tunnel called like the Manson tunnel, or did they mean?
I had this question as well. We don't know LA well enough to, let me see, the Manson Tunnel. Oh, it is related to Charles Manson. Well, this is just the AI overview, but no, yeah. Yeah, so one of the Manson victims was in this tunnel, I think, was discovered in this tunnel.
Oh, right, this tunnel right here. Yeah, with this
Ron
was like
Baker.
The Manson family.
Wasn't that
family.
The guy who got murdered in the OJ case?
No, that's Ron Goldman.
Oh, sorry. Sorry. Anyway.
OJ makes a stunning appearance on this episode of the Versus podcast.
If there was a crossover between OJ and the Manson case, wouldn't that be crazy? Come on.
That would be crazy. That would be crazy. And honestly, not that out of character. He was pretty demonic.
No.
And we're glad he's
dead.
But
anyway, what the other thing you need to understand about this scene is that they've got this great visual gag of just like this long line of people sitting in handcuffs at the police station. They're all like dirty and beat up. Like it's all these different people who have been looking for the treasure and who have gotten arrested for it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, no porch pirate, I guess. But anyways.
No porch pirate.
Athena gets home from a long day of work and you hear Bobby in the other room. Instantly, you think he's going to be like cooking naked or something. And it's going to be like a reveal like, oh, here's Bobby's bare ass, which we see later on in the show, I believe. But it's not that cool and it's not that fun. Instead, you get a different sort of bait and switch where Bobby's like putting something outside. And I immediately wrote in my notes, oh, he's hiding all his drugs.
Well,
but
yeah,
again.
I feel like in a sort of disrespectful way or insensitive way, you are supposed to kind of be like, oh, God, has he relapsed? But no, he's clearly, as soon as Athena comes in, he's clearly hiding something. And he's like, oh, I'm just making some breakfast. Yeah. And she gets into the kitchen and he's like hastily stowing something behind the back door, the kitchen door. And she's like immediately suspicious. He's trying to deflect. He's like, hey, you want some French toast? You want some coffee? But she goes outside. She finds Bobby's Stiles Stilinski conspiracy board.
That's exactly what it is. It's a Stiles Stilinski conspiracy board.
Investigating the treasure himself. Even Bobby has bought into it.
Athena, you know, leans over to him and goes, how many Adderall have you taken today? He's like, a couple. Why?
She discovers the conspiracy board. And he's really done some investigating. He's trying to convince mm-hmm. her. And she's like, why do you care so much? Like, mm-hmm. why are you into this? And he's like, well, it's a lot of money. You know, it's kind of like playing the lottery. And she's like, nobody ever got killed playing the lottery. And he's like,
oh.
Well,
oh.
Yeah, like, don't even say that.
I love a dad with a project. I really do. But yeah, no, he reveals that, like, you know, what if I find the treasure and then I could surprise you with like trust funds for the kids, a new kitchen, a new house. Oh my God. We could build a whole new life together. Or we could retire.
Maybe. We could finally retire. And she, I think, understandably is like, whoa, 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 like, what do you mean? And he's like, well, we can't do our jobs forever. And she's like, well, I never want to retire, you know, like, they'll never get me out. And he's like, well, somebody almost did last year. It's weird how fast this turns serious, right?
Yeah.
She's like, well, I considered retiring when that happened, but I decided not to, and it's fine. And Bobby's like, oh, you never told me that. And she's like, I didn't think I had to, because it was such a, you know, the decision was already made. I like barely, mm-hmm. I didn't really mull over it much. But you can tell that Bobby's a little disturbed by the idea that she, you know, had this idea and decided against it all by herself without him. And yeah. this is sort of planting seeds for a larger thing to go up between them.
Subtle rough patch arc seeds, you know, that we've been getting sprinkled in throughout the season. It's good. It's mm-hmm. good. Athena like cuts off the conversation before yeah. like they can even really get into it. She's like, about that French toast. By the way, this is such a stupid thing. I might say something stupid, but
mm-hmm.
I hate that the word French is capitalized in French toast because it just
you think
makes
they
it
don't
look
deserve
weird.
That?
Well, well, yes, but also, I want to write out French toast, just like lowercase, like I do waffles or pancakes, but I can't because I have to capitalize.
Well, I think
the
you
French.
Can. Like nobody's forcing you. We need to check like elements of style
wrong.
Or something and see what they say about this.
Elements of styles. Now, what was I going to say? Oh, fuck. What was I going to say? Oh, yes. Yes, I'm back. I got it. Athena is actually right on the money with this whole thing. I'm sorry. I'm Team Athena.
I was a little on her side, too.
As we know now, she will never mm-hmm. grow old with this man.
Ooh. I was kind of on her side, too. I do, as I've said before, I really like the final conflict between the two of them. And I do see Bobby's side of it, because I think generally it's true that she kind of still has this wall up and doesn't always include her, or it doesn't always include him in her thoughts. But in this particular situation, yeah, I think, especially given that Athena endured this trauma and was getting over it in her own way, not that she shouldn't have let Bobby in, but I do kind of feel like if she didn't, you know, if she very briefly was told to consider retirement and, you know, kind of instantly decided that's not what she wanted to do, I don't really think she, you know, I don't think she should necessarily be told she was wrong for mm-hmm. not having the conversation with Bobby. If it, you know, I think in general, I don't know. It's just one of those things where you can see why it perturbs Bobby potentially, because this is a pattern of behavior. But
yeah.
individually, I don't think she was necessarily wrong for it.
Yeah, no, I just think that she has psychic powers. But we get a lingering shot on Bobby's sad face and his swollen arms because he's so buff.
Do you think he still made the French toast, though? Do you think he just sulkily made the French toast?
I think he very somberly made the French toast, very morosely yeah. made like a sad batch of French toast that still tasted delicious.
It tasted delicious, but there was a hint of melancholy in the flavor.
Exactly. It's in the spices he used. He used cinnamon. And like a dash of like nutmeg or something. I don't know.
And then he cried a single tear into it that made it taste of sadness.
That's how I like mine. I like mine with Bobby Nash.
I like mine like that too. But elsewhere, this woman is shiftily checking into a charming little bed and breakfast or something. She wants the Willow Tree Suite.
This actress was on
13 Reasons Why, I'm pretty sure.
She was?
I think she was the love interest for Tyler. I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure she was.
Which one was
and
Tyler
I,
again?
And you might... the school shooter one who was in an episode
of
911.
Oh, that's right, that's right.
And
that's
you
right,
might be
right.
thinking, you might be thinking this actress looks too old to play a teenager. Well, guess what? She did on 13 Reasons Why as well. It didn't matter. She was still on it.
It's a show. It's whatever.
Yeah, it's, but
she
know.
Was in
so
13
anyway,
episodes.
She...
Wow. Damn.
She's very apt. She's seeming a little shifty. She like keeps looking out the window, but she tells the guy, the like charming old man working at the bed and breakfast. Side note, I've been watching so many Lifetime Christmas movies recently that this felt so Lifetime Christmas movie coded to me, like, mm-hmm. oh, the charming bed and breakfast and the kindly old man who runs it. But she tells him that, oh, me and my boyfriend are checking in and I'm hopeful, you know, just between us that he might finally propose soon. And maybe this charming bed and breakfast will put him in the mood. And she's like, oh, my boyfriend, he's just right outside. He's getting our bags. Yeah. She goes outside to meet him.
He's got tools.
She goes outside to meet him. He's got tools. He is like getting ready to dig on a part of the land. She's stalling for a while.
You can immediately see they're kind of like a mismatched couple down to like the stylings of the characters, like in terms of like jewelry and like the way that they style their clothes.
They've made her look like a kind of nice, normal, like put together woman. And then he looks a little, I don't know if it's like the facial hair or the shirt he's wearing or the haircut he has, or no offense, but just like the face of this man. But he looks like a delinquent.
He looks like a bargain bin 90s Johnny Depp. Yikes. He looks like dark and
somehow scarier.
Wife beatery. Like he looks like unstable.
I mean, he just looks like he would be cast as an extra who's like a burglar in a movie. You know?
Exactly. You know, and his hair flops in the wind because it's long.
His hair flops in the wind. It's like a little greasy looking. He's got that like evil, devilish goatee and mustache. He kind of looks like Gary Oldman, actually. No offense to Gary Oldman after that description I just gave of this man. And no offense to this man either. He looks normal, but it's,
we are tearing this man to shreds. Because first of all,
he just looks kind of evil and shady. And
first of all,
like
we insult him by comparing him to Johnny Depp, and then we insult Gary Oldman by comparing discount 90s Johnny Depp to him.
He really does look like Gary Oldman. I'm sorry, I'm noticing that. He looks like a young Gary Oldman. But the important part is he's starting to dig on the land.
The bone structure is also giving a little bit of our boy Skeet Ulrich. Bringing it back.
Sure.
You know?
I guess people in the 90s just looked like that. Yeah.
White boys.
He's starting to dig on the property, and the kindly old man comes out and he's like, hey, what are you doing? Like, get off my property. And he starts to walk over to the old man, the shady guy does, leaving his girlfriend standing there on top of the ground. Ground starts to shake. She falls right in to the earth, like the earth opens up, and the boyfriend and the old man are like, what's that smell? 118 shows up. Oh my god, the
what's
septic
that smell
tank.
We got
the
something to sell. It's called street
through.
Meat. No need to yell. Sorry, it's a very niche reference. It's a septic tank. The roof is rusted through. She is swimming in filth down there in a pool of methane and undesirable waste.
Yes, she is in a big tank of human waste.
Liquid shit.
Yes. And the old man's like, what the hell were you doing? The guy's like, this is the River's Edge B&B with the Willow Tree Suite. These are both like references to the treasure poem. So he's like, the treasure has to be here. But it's clearly not. All that was here was a rusted through septic tank. The 118's like, how are we going to get in there? They drop her some oxygen. And they're like, Buck, why don't you do this? You take this one, buddy.
Said you can get, we did say you can get the next one. And it's like, that's not what I meant. And so they lower him down.
He's so mad.
He's so mad.
It's like when you give a dog a bath. He's like, how dare you?
Literally. And he gets a bath.
They put him in this sort of hazmat suit. He gets a bath, not in a clean way. They lower him down. and this girl starts drowning.
It's like she gets her foot yanked out from under her like she's Luke Skywalker in the trash compactor. It's weird. And so like you don't know what's happening, but she starts drowning in the shit water, and so Buck has to drop down in there.
By the way, like add an entry to my worst ways to die list, because drowning in decomposing human waste at the bottom of a septic tank just put me down before I get to that point.
Yeah. I will say though, that would be a decent copypasta. You see a photo of Buck looking all nasty and gross, and you say, until the room smells like a septic tank full of decomposing human waste.
That is absolutely disgusting, Ryan.
Ooh, London jumped out.
I was so offended.
Strange Gary Oldman guy is in the ambulance with the diva who's covered in filth, and she says, it's okay, I don't need the money. I just need
but
you.
But yes,
to put
I
a
will
ring on
marry
it
you, Gary
if
Oldman.
If you like it.
And he's like, oh, I didn't mean that. Funny
Let's
story.
Take that again.
I'm actually...
Let's take that again. He goes, oh!
Yes. He goes, oh, you didn't know? I'm already married.
Oh, my God.
What
She's
a piece
the other
of
woman.
Shit.
She's the other woman.
Yeah, he's like, baby, you're my side piece. And she throws him out of the ambulance, understandably. Yeah. Side note, I know it smells crazy in there.
If I was him, I would have been glad to be free of the scent.
I think in a way he probably was. But yeah, he gets out of the ambulance. All the firefighters are looking at him.
Is this because he didn't seem to like her that much? Like, he really seems to be...
No, he certainly didn't.
Yeah, so...
I feel this poor woman, what a terrible life to lead.
She's on the hook. She's on the hook, and it blew up in her face. Ladies, respect yourself more than this. Don't fall for these schemes. Otherwise, you will fall into the septic tank.
Exactly.
Now, back in L.A., Athena rolls up to the Gothic mansion.
Let's just say, first, he gets out of the ambulance. He explains to, like, Buck, Eddie,
Buddy
and Bobby.
Moment.
He's like, she needed some space. And then you see Buck is, like, getting out of his septic clothes. And both Bobby and Eddie kind of get these looks on their face, like, ugh, that smell. And they just kind of walk away from Buck, who's like, come on, guys. Poor
Ryan Guzman, for all of his faults, one thing I can say of genuine praise is he does a good pungent stench look. You know, he does a good, like, I just caught a foul smell look, you know, because
it's his natural comedic abilities.
Exactly. He should have been in the 40s. Then his awful opinions would have been okay.
Literally.
Normal.
He could have had a trad wife and been happy. Aw, born in the wrong generation.
He
so
really was.
Anyway,
he just wanted to dance.
Athena, that's a great point. Athena gets a notification. I don't know why I said notification. She gets notified in some way. there's the burglar alarm is going off in Hollis Harcourt's house.
Yes.
HHH.
Hollis Harcourt's house.
And the assistant called, I think. The Smithers called the police about it. So she goes into the house with
Smithers.
Her gun, assuming that there's an intruder. But who should she find sitting in his office but Hollis himself?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The man of the hour.
He's not really dead.
Well, here he is. You know, wake up, dead man, because she actually says looking pretty good for a dead man. Good one-liner.
Yes, classic
good
Athena
Angela Bassett one-liner.
Maybe Ryan Johnson watches 9-1-1 and he saw this episode and got the inspiration for the third Knives Out.
We should
I
say.
I haven't seen it yet, so I couldn't
neither
tell
of us
you
have
how
seen
similar
it
is, but.
Yeah. if it is similar, Ryan, we're looking down through our lenses at you, sir. Thank you for making such good movies. I thoroughly enjoyed the first two. I'm looking forward to the third. Now Smithers comes in and he's like, "You bastard! You're alive! You're such an ass!" And Athena's like,
"You kind of
you
get
know,
this very subtle subtext that perhaps the assistant has always been an unrequited love with Hollis, who's such an asshole." And so he kind of, that's why he's stuck around.
We get that because he's the Smithers. That's the whole point
exactly.
of the Smithers.
Exactly. So
15 years of working
I see
for this
you.
Man.
I see you, Grossman and Goodman. The queer subtext of your work.
And I will say, you know, this unmarried, you know, mystery author guy, he is also giving major gay vibes.
But he's like an evil gay guy.
Exactly.
He's very misanthropic. He hates everyone.
I just know that he did some like weird shit in the 80s. You know what I mean? Like he did some weird shit in the 80s and 90s.
Like
before
paying
woke
men to
existed.
Like walk crawl around on the floor and lick his shoes and stuff.
Like he's one of the oligarchs in Solo, like
yeah, pretty much. That's what I'm picturing for him.
I see that for him. I see that for this 57-year-old man. I see him being Solo core, but he'd do it in like
Athena's
Fire Island.
Like, Athena's like, I think we need to have a little chat. You know, you're probably guilty of like fraud and forging some documents. And Hollis is like, well, I didn't really do any of those things. All I did was have my team like issue a statement saying I've died. And then everybody assumed I died. Like he's kind of saying I didn't do any of the legal things that can be a problem if you fake your own death.
Is that true?
I've been told, I have heard that faking your own death isn't technically illegal. It's like Athena's saying, it's more like the accompanying things. Like if you were to do like life insurance fraud or, you know, some of the legal trappings of these things. But I would think that just announcing to the public that you've died is not illegal.
No, I would agree with that. I would agree with probably even, you know, publishing a false obituary isn't a crime. But mm-hmm. What I would say is that he did, on some level, incite mass hysteria, right?
Well, like, that's kind of what Athena says.
Couldn't he at least be charged with, like, disturbing the peace, you know?
There's property
damage involved.
There's
bodily damage involved. Like, this is
right. Because she tells him, like, you know, your treasure has been causing a lot of people to get hurt. The guy reveals that he's actually done this entire thing because he needs an ending to his next novel.
He's got writer's block.
It's called Gutted in Glendale.
Gutted in Glendale.
It's about this treasure hunt, but he can't figure out the ending. And, you know, he's already gotten his advance. He's already sold the film rights. Tom Hanks wants to star. He loves these blood and treasure stories. So he is trying to do a little social experiment to find out how the story ends. And he says, you know, it's confirming everything I always suspected about this city, that it's all full of selfish, greedy morons.
He says it's going to be like the Da Vinci Code, only bigger. And if you didn't know, this guy was a hack already. Like, this should, yeah, this should seal the deal, because I don't know if any of you guys have read the Da Vinci Code. It's not a good book. Like, it's like a lot of the prose is like, is kind of embarrassing to read.
Yeah, kind of famously.
Yeah, but it was a big success. It was a big commercial success. So he's chasing that
high. I just need a little more time. I just need a little more time to find my ending. So why don't we just keep this between the two of us? But Athena's like, you know, your alarm call, it went out on the radio. So some curious reporters are probably going to ask me some questions, and I'm going to tell them the truth.
Wasn't this a Supernatural episode? Wasn't this the premise for that Supernatural episode that was like the weird meta school play fan fiction episode?
You know, it's been too long and I never watched the entire show. I do remember catching that episode live on TV, but all I really remember is that there was a musical of Supernatural and they like talked about shipping.
Yeah, we do explore the nature of Destiel, you know, subtext.
Athena's not at the 118, but she's communicated to the 118, who are now all sitting around and chatting.
Okay, No. Eddie is standing so sassily with his little pool cue. It needs mm-hmm. to be noted. It needs to be noted how sassily he's standing
it's
with his
true.
Pool cue. He
he's
has his like chin,
Kubrick
little
stare,
like
if
a fucking yeah, a little Kubrick stare. His chin is tucked in. He's got his hands up around it. He's
well,
he's got,
pouting.
Even a little
he's
bit of
pouting
a,
because
the pout.
He says
yes.
He says we should have been paid for being Hollis Harcourt's lab rats. Wah wah wah. He's so sad.
With that snatched waist, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Are you kidding me? Ugh.
Yeah.
Now I don't see this hurting Harcourt. Is it Harcourt? Hollis Harcourt? Harcourt's career.
Yeah.
And Chimney even seems to be taking this in stride because, of course, he's also read the guy's books. Apparently it seems to be like kind of like even if it is like a step beyond what you'd expect from the guy, like it does seem within the realm of possibility. It's like if Stephen King was discovered to have murdered somebody in the 80s. You know what I mean? It's like,
and we don't know that he didn't.
We don't know that he didn't. He was doing a lot of cocaine in the 80s. Okay.
Right.
He was
under the influence often. But back at the Baylor/Tuck household,
ooh,
they are drinking.
Ooh.
They're
Tuck
drinking
writes.
Because Taylor's feeling really stupid for being a smart lady who fell for the buried treasure plot. It's funny because the point of this scene is that Buck just wants to to give in to their carnal desires.
Yeah.
But Taylor is a little too distracted by the whole case. She's like, man, I can't believe I fell for that. She walks over to another part of the room and she's like, this guy, he's such a bad person. He took us all for fools. And Buck is doing that thing. He's practically like leaning in for the kiss, like mm-hmm. closing his eyes. And she's like already getting another thought. She's like thinking about something else.
You
she's
would
like,
be forgiven
no.
watching all of their scenes in this episode for thinking that she was absolutely not into him at all. You'd
yeah.
be so forgiven.
Yeah, it's like
for
her
that.
Mind is completely elsewhere.
It's like she sees him as like her little brother or something like that. you know, like, and is completely oblivious. Yeah. Yeah, her, like, her pet dog.
She's like, I fed you already. Stop bothering me.
And he just has these, like, sad, emotive eyes that are just so piercing. And she's just like...
He's like, please, what about Taylor, this please, thing can we have sex tonight?
Consider? And she's like, what about the case?
Yeah, yeah. She's like, oh, that it just occurred to me that he used to go jogging every day. Like, she is in another world. And then back at Bobby and Athena's place, they're also reconsidering the case. Athena comes in and Bobby's like putting his shit away and saying, I guess it was all not real. But also, it's interesting because it looks like they've made up since the last scene. They're like totally friendly again. I think they're just
compartmentalizing, really, you know?
Yes, they didn't really take the time to unpack their little conversation earlier.
Which is so good. The pressure can build. Leave that as it is so that it blows up at a really pivotal moment in the finale. That's good.
Right. Bottle it up, people.
Bobby, he does seem disappointed about like the lack of riches and fame and fortune and stuff like that. And Athena asks him, do you even know how to fish?
Little fishing cabin.
She asks, do you even know how to fish? And he's like, I'm from Minnesota. And I took that to mean Bobby does know how to fish, but only ice fish.
Only ice fishing? Yeah. Yeah.
Have you ever gone ice fishing? Is that a thing?
I'm also from St. Paul, Minnesota, and I've never gone fishing.
Ever?
Nope.
Not even ice fishing?
Nope.
Have you skated on the frozen lake?
Oh, of course. But that's a far cry from... You need, like, equipment to go ice fishing. You need the big ice drill. Because there's, like, a good foot or a couple of feet of ice to drill through. At least if you're doing it safely.
Does anyone in your family ice fish?
Not my immediate family. I might have some... I probably have some relatives who have done it.
Have you ever met anyone?
I had an uncle who died on a fishing trip.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I don't want to say anything insensitive.
It was before I was born.
Oh, okay.
But
R.I.P. Jane's uncle.
That's not like the reason I haven't gone fishing. It's not like out of trauma, but I have never gone fishing. So I think Bobby's making a bit of a generalization about Minnesotans and fishing, but maybe a man of his age, maybe it's reasonable.
Mm-hmm. Like, he doesn't understand what it's like to be a Gen Z woman in the Twin Cities. You know, he's out of touch.
Who has no interest in sports or the outdoors, yeah.
Exactly. He, like, you know, although you did go camping. You did go to those campgrounds.
He did go camping, where he and Michael explored each other's bodies.
Well, you also went camping. You also went camping where you learned a great deal about the true nature of wolves.
Yeah, I went to a weird hippie school that did a lot of camping trips. But, to be clear, Wijiwagen, that was in the sixth grade, and that we stayed in cabins, I think. That was not camping.
But
Athena sits down and she starts reading the shitty poem. She too reflects on the bad prose. She and Bobby like commiserate over it.
Mm-hmm.
But she actually gets she has a new perspective on it, because there's a line in there about a narrow place. Mm-hmm. And Bobby's like, I still never figured out what that part meant. And she thinks about it and she goes, wait. The title of his next book was Gutted in Glendale. I think I know where the treasure is. It's like, okay.
How good is that when it's the character who doesn't give a fuck about it knows?
Right? That's how it always goes.
I love it. It gets me every time. I'm a sucker for it. I'm not going to lie. And I also love that, again, this is very Glass Onion to me, because the thing that they weren't considering, they were reading too deep into the poem, the thing they weren't considering is that the guy's an idiot. He's a bad writer.
Yeah.
He's a hack. You know, it's literally Glass Onion. It's Glass Onion. He's an idiot. It's the whole point. And so they go to the Glendale Narrows,
which is like this concrete channel full of water. It's not like a literal river. It's like a little canal.
Eagle-eyed players of Grand Theft Auto 5 will recognize this as the place where I think it was Michael or Franklin. I think Franklin drives through this bit during a getaway when they're getting Michael's daughter off of the fuck yacht. It's a whole thing. Play the game.
Okay.
It's not a river, so nobody thought it was a river, but it's more of like a drainage system out into the ocean. And it's concrete and it's ugly, and they find this gate with herons on it, and you hear bullfrogs and everything. It's all in the poem. And who should show up to crash their little party crash their little party. But, that's Hen and Chim. That's Hen and Chim and Buddy.
And then Buddy walk up.
Mm-hmm. And they all came to the conclusions.
They've brought their gear because they didn't know what the terrain would be like. And, you know, Hen and Chimney brought their med kits because you've seen what's been happening this week. Everybody's been, you know, it's been a bloodbath. Mm-hmm. And they realize, they finally, they make peace. They're like, okay, we'll just split it like seven ways between all of us and Taylor Kelly and her cameraman. We hear the helicopter all like above them. Don't worry, it's not Tommy Kennard. It's our other wonderful TK, not the one from Lone Star. It's Taylor Kelly.
It's Taylor Kelly. Whoa. Taylor Kelly, flip it around. TK, flip it around. Tommy Kennard, flip it around. Wicked Witch.
Flip it around. Tim Kinear.
Tristan Kreidel.
Tristan Kreidel. It's all connected. Her web connects them all.
Yes, Tristan. We learned how the other groups figured it out. Taylor said that Hollis used to jog around here. Strange place to jog. Mm-hmm. Also, don't jog on concrete. That's really bad for your joints. And Hen says something hysterical, which is that she and Chimney found it out because Karen wrote an algorithm that detects changes in satellite images.
They kind of move on, Karen, from that too quickly.
I love that that Buddy and Bathina did like the proper Batman detective work, and
right,
like
everybody else kind of cheated,
and Hen and Karen went the Dark Knight surveillance state route. So that was very funny. And Athena has a hysterical reaction to this. She says, also, pretty sure this is the first time any of us are hearing about an algorithm. And the delivery of the word algorithm is so funny. And then she makes this snarling face at Hen with her lip like up, exposing her top teeth. It's very like the disgust on her face is hysterical. She's so mad. They're all mad. They all want the money for themselves. They're gonna split it seven ways because, of course, you know, Taylor and her cameraman are there, etc. Then they get past the Heron Gate. They do the math on how much that split would be. It's very fun. It's very funny.
But they're all standing there, like looking down from the bridge, looking down at the river, like, yes, okay, how are we gonna find it? It's gotta be on one of those little islands. How will we know which one it is? Oh, Robbie's there. And he's already digging it up.
God damn it, Rob.
I guess we can just go to him and split the money eight ways. So bold of them to assume that they'd be able to, like, intimidate him into splitting the money with them, even though he found it first.
Are you kidding me? He's so excited. He's so excited. He would probably offer. He'd probably offer.
Maybe. Because he wants to get in good with these guys. And we see this later in the episode. I think Ravi, despite his innocent exterior, was already kind of evil and disliked all of them.
Well, that's true. I mean, he is a landlord as well. So, you know, there's a greedy side there.
He possesses the kind of greed they talked about in the Bible. So they're all gathered around the treasure chest and they're like, Robbie, why don't you do the honors since you were here first? And he's like, all right, it's pretty light. So I'm thinking maybe there's just a check in there instead of the actual jewels, which, you know, that makes sense. Who would put the actual jewels in there? He opens it up. Oh, it's empty. It's empty. It's just an empty chest. And Athena's like, I think we need to have a word with Mr. Harcourt. So like an angry mob, they all drive over to his house.
They get their pitchforks
to be like,
and torches
out. Hey, Mr., what's the deal?
Can I just say, it's so funny to me, the implication that Ravi has no friends.
because yeah, he's doing
this all alone. He could not rope a single person into doing this with him. And to me, that's very charming.
I mean, what kind of like 27-year-old landlord has friends, you know?
That's true. That's true. Maybe other landlord friends, and they don't want to do the dirty work. They can't get their hands dirty. They don't even have a real job. But they roll up to the Gothic mansion with ivy growing on it. There's ivy growing on it. It's a whole thing. And the gate is unlocked and the door is open. Ooh, suspicious. I wonder if Smithers finally did it.
Athena is like, you guys stay here. I'm the only one with a gun, she says as she like brandishes it up in the air, which I feel like is not good gun etiquette, good gun safety.
I mean, she is she, practicing like, good trigger safety with having her finger off of the trigger and on the side instead.
But I feel like you shouldn't just like thrust it up in the air to show off that you have a gun in front of a bunch of people. She's like, everybody stay here.
Have you considered this shot is so cunty? This shot is so good.
I guess that's true.
Because she's not in her police uniform anymore, I can enjoy it. Angela Bassett holding a pistol with the rest of the cast looking at her like concerned and stuff. And she it's just goes cute. Right in. Peering around the corners. Yes. I love it. I bought into it. I love the civilian clothes that she's wearing in this as well. But yes, what should she find?
But the corpse of Hollis Harcourt. He's dead for real. What the fuck? She checks him out. He's dead. The entire 118 walk in. And she's like, didn't I tell you to wait outside? Like, what is wrong with you people? I would have liked if at this point Buck was suddenly like, what do you mean, you people? But nobody says that. But they hear sirens in the distance, and Hen is like, well, maybe it's good we came in here so that we can be your alibi. Because, yeah, we've got a dead guy in the house, nobody else is here, but you're standing over him with a gun.
Mm-hmm. And
so Fabrizio shows up. Well, actually, first, we cut to a news report on the scene. Taylor Kelly is on the scene. This is, like, excellent comedic delivery from Megan West. She's so funny here because she says the famed author has been found dead again in this great like her face, her deadpan is so good. I love
she
that.
Does a little shake of her head between the words and everything. It's so good. And then Fabrizio is interrogating them in like a Usual Suspects style lineup.
And he's like, you drove down here like an angry mob to confront him and now he's dead, but these facts are unrelated to each other. Which is a good question.
It is a good question. However, it's also very clear that he does not think any of them killed the guy. A fact confirmed by the fact that the medical examiner or whatever comes out and is like, no, it's like CSI comes out and it's like, we got the security footage. It wasn't them. And he's like,
right.
I didn't actually think it was. I was just, you know,
enjoying the moment.
Doing my job and, you know, kind of liking it for once, you know?
But a great moment here is that before CSI comes in and says, you know, I saw the security footage, it's not them, Ravi says, oh, I don't actually really know these guys. I'm not really with them.
He's
again,
so tiny.
Exposing that he's not really, you know, he doesn't really care about any of them. I don't think he would have split the money with them.
This is why Ravi has no friends, because he's a backstabber. Because he's a double-crossing traitor.
It's not like,
Ravi has no friends, and he never will.
It's not like anyone was nice to him prior to this. Like, I feel like he has earned
Nor
the right
should they
to, like,
be. Nor should they be. He's
the,
a
well,
rat. Ravi the rat.
Damn. Ravi the rat. He would rat on all of them in prison. Ravi throws everybody under the bus, but yes, somebody comes in and says, we saw the footage, it's not them.
Mm-hmm.
Who was it, you ask?
It's a person disguised as a delivery person, it appears to be.
Yes, a pregnant delivery woman comes to the door on the security footage, and they're like, I don't think, you know, that's not one of their trucks, that's not a real delivery driver.
Yeah.
And it turns out, this is the woman from earlier who ran up to stole Taylor Kelly's mic and said, it's a hoax. It's a hoax. My husband almost died. And they take her in to interrogate her.
Mm-hmm. It turns out that, as she's being interrogated, she insists that she didn't kill him. And so we see the flashback of the events. And she's telling the truth, kinda, because as she's confronting him about what an awful person he is, awful people, he starts to get chest pains. He doesn't give a fuck about her dead husband. He's pushing her out. She accidentally, they bump into the table and they shatter a crystal vase, etc.
Yeah.
And he starts freaking out because it was expensive. And so Glass Onion, she starts fucking ripping the other stuff off of the shelves and smashing that right in front of him. And what does he do, this drama queen head ass? He has a heart attack.
He fucking dies.
I mean, dies.
First he calls 911, but, you know, then he starts clutching his chest. He can't even talk to 911. She, being a decently principled person, despite coming in and breaking into his house and breaking all his stuff, she's like, oh my God, like, are you okay? She runs over to the phone. She's gonna continue the call. But then she's like, wait a minute. What if I just left him here to die? You know, why shouldn't I? And she, you know, on the phone.
Left them there to die.
On the phone, they're like, hello, this is 911. Like, press a button if you're there. And she's just like, you know what? I'm going to hang up.
Yeah.
You know, she's channeling Gloria.
She just, she drops the phone. She drops the phone. She doesn't hang up. She drops the phone and she leaves him there to die.
She books it.
Very stunning moment of like time catching up for me, because I believe this guy has the same make and model of iPhone as I do. I believe he has an iPhone 11, and I'm gonna upgrade my phone in a couple weeks because it's paid off and I need to get a new phone plan. But that was just very funny to me. That tickled me because I think I got mine in 2021 as well.
I just love this scene. I love this girl. Like, this diva is cold. She, like, this is such a kind of weirdly epic moment for this random one-off character.
So then the question remains.
Her husband.
The question remains, is this a crime? Like,
and I think kinda? In real life, you could, if they had the evidence to prove that she had actively, like, left, I think it could count as a crime. But Athena and Fabrizio seem to be like, let's just not bother.
Plus, she does have a bit of plausible deniability.
If she didn't hang up the phone, I don't think they have enough evidence. Although, if they have the security footage of her, maybe there's no security footage of inside the house. Maybe they just were able to see her enter. Because I guess they just don't have enough evidence to get her on anything. And as Athena points out, she's like, everybody just wants this case to be over with. Like, the city doesn't want to deal with this.
The woman's pregnant, so I guess, and it's fine. An awful guy that nobody liked died. True. Who cares? This is the first moment in the entire show where Athena went,
Yeah, let's just let her off the hook.
Good character growth for Athena. Yes,
right.
Love to see it. And then we get the post dead author wrap up brunch and everyone's invited, including Taylor Kelly, who's a part of the gang now. She's a part of the gang now. Oh, I was so happy to see it.
I love the concept of Athena inviting Taylor Kelly into her home. Like, it just feels a little wrong, but I'm glad she's there.
Now, Buck has a funny line where he's like, you know, I don't even know who to trust anymore. I don't trust anyone. And everyone's like, well, except you guys, you guys are great, but fuck everyone else. And then Eddie's like, especially that assistant, the Smithers, right? Jeremiah. And, and then Athena Grant, the master detective that she is, does the Perry Mason wrap up.
Yes, she's like, you know, he seemed just as surprised as I was about Hollis being alive the first time. He was really angry. And she realizes, she's like, Hollis didn't bury the treasure himself. He would have had Smithers do his dirty work. So we get a little flashback of, like, Hollis, you know, guilt tripping and manipulating Smithers.
Makes up this like bogus story about like, oh, I'm dying of cancer or whatever.
Yeah.
And
I don't have a lot of time left.
You need to bury this for me. My little henchman.
So he does, but after being not only left out of Hollis's fake will, which was obviously very hurtful to him, and, you know, finding out that Hollis was actually alive and had manipulated him, what do you know? Maybe Smithers was the one to steal the treasure. you know, after hearing all this.
Mm-hmm. And apparently, turns out,
he's just chartered a flight to the Maldives.
To the Maldives. No extradition treaty. So no way to get him back with all of that loot.
And I mean, as they also say, they're like, did he even commit a crime?
No.
Like, not really.
Not really. I mean, like, you could, I mean, the gold was considered abandoned material. Yeah, like, so that's just his. And he went to the Maldives, and, you know, that's that. And Taylor's station is like, you know what? We like the he died and there is no treasure story better than the Maldives.
Because she's outside on the phone with her like station being like, hey, do you think you could send me to the Maldives to report on this? And they're like, no.
They're like, no.
We're shutting that down.
You need to come into work on Monday. This is a job.
Yeah. We're a local LA news station. We're not spending like $1 million to send you to the Maldives and, you know, pay for all your shit.
Oh, do you want us to put you up at the White Lotus too? Have you sipping on your pina coladas on the beach while you leisurely report on this story? So
you got to report on traffic tomorrow.
And so she's like, fine.
Buck comes out, not of the closet, but of the house to talk to Taylor, and they ruminate on how they make a pretty good team, don't they?
Mm-hmm. And she's like, I'm so lucky to have a friend like you.
Taylor Kelly zoned.
Taylor Kelly zoned. This is what men complain about all the time. Just not getting into Taylor Kelly's... I don't even want to go there.
Pantsuit.
Then
business casual clothing.
Exactly. And then the episode ends on that lovely moment of chaste friendship yearning.
Buck blue balled him.
Buck blue balls. Yeah. And that is how it ends. And it cuts to black. How
it's so crazy that they thought this was worthy of the cliffhanger. Well, or not cliffhanger, but you know, that this would be like the emotional moment they end the episode on.
I liked that for this episode. I'm not going to lie.
No, I do too. It's just funny to me.
It did tickle me. Something I love about this episode is that, you know, they don't try to moralize anything other than that this author's an awful person. They don't try to moralize like the ethics of like stealing the gold from the guy, even though it's not stealing. They don't moralize like the not saving his life.
Well, yeah, it's not like the heist episode where at the end, you know, the guy who tried to steal the diamonds out from under the real thief's nose, they like have him die as a consequence. They're like, oh, I guess that's why you shouldn't steal diamonds or whatever. In this, it's just like, yeah, fuck that guy. Smithers got his treasure and now he's going to live out the rest of his life rich and having a great time.
And it's awesome. It's awesome. I'm so happy for him.
And that pregnant lady gets to just like get off scot-free. No, this is a great episode for the anti-heroes, for the morally ambiguous characters and the sort of justice outside of the law. So that's an interesting development for the show.
I loved all like the twists and turns that this took. It was so fun and it was such a romp. I just like, this is classic 911 to me. Like this is like what the show like at its core, like its appeal to me is, because it's like you have all these like memorable characters who we all love engaging these ridiculous wild scenarios, acting sort of weirdly realistically like how excitable somewhat juvenile adults would act with their positions of authority to track down this childish game of treasure hunt that you know at its core could make you a very rich person. It's so campy and over the top and fun. I love it. And so, yeah, I was a huge, huge fan of this episode. It feels so good. It feels so good. This is why I love this show.
This season has really just been a romp and a half.
Mm-hmm.
So much fun, so much levity.
I'm going to miss it so much. I'm going to miss it so much.
I know.
However,
I know.
Next week, Jane, next week.
The next 2 weeks are going to be buddy maxing to the max, you guys.
It's legendary. Guys,
and you know, just in time for the holidays.
Just in time for the holidays. And I have been down on Buddy recently, but I want everyone in our audience to know And this isn't me talking out of my own ass. Like, I'm being so genuine when I say it's been long enough that I've completely looped back around to Buddy Cannon. 9B yes. is going to be our year. 2026 is going to be our year, guys. It's finally happening.
You guys, it's
finally
happening.
We have never been so back. We have never been so back.
We have never been so back. All roads lead to Buddy.
As they should, as written. It is known.
As the prophecy proclaimed.
Yeah. So
foretold.
With that, I have 10 minutes before I have to leave for work. So thank you guys so much for listening to another thrilling installment of the First Risk podcast. If you'd like to support our show further, follow us on social media at First Risk podcast, spelled how it sounds. And if you'd like to go even further than that, because you love us so much, you can subscribe to our Patreon, where we put out a new bonus episode every month. We just put out our new one a couple weeks ago, co-starring our lovely, lovely, wonderful friend of the pod, Justin Gross, where we finally watched the Lone Star crossover. And this
exciting month stuff
is a very interesting month, because we have a pretty neck and neck race for the topical. It'll be decided by this point. But I think there's one topic that's winning by one vote. Let me pull up Patreon right now to check. Yes, winning by one vote is identifying fanfic tropes in 9-1-1.
Interesting.
Stay tuned for that. That's a new addition to the poll, by the way. This is the first month this has been on the poll, and I love that everyone jumped on it. I am still crossing my fingers that one day we will get 9-1-1 characters' favorite musicals, according to Jane and Ryan, because that's going to be very
fun
to do when it wins.
It'll happen one day. We've just got to leave it on the poll.
One
day. Same with Mind Hunters. What's the name of the movie?
Mind Gamers. and of course, watching the first and last episodes of Ghost Whisperer, which is going
to
be so fun.
We'll get
too.
To all of it. You know, check out the Patreon if you want to make your voice heard on some of these important issues. And yeah, thanks for listening. Everybody have a wonderful, wonderful Buck Taylor Eddie Thruple filled lead up to the holidays, and let us know in the comments what your favorite 9-1-1 thruples and polycules are.